Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 21st episode of Korea Startup Podcast. Today, we are with Laida. Hello, Laida.
Hi.
And we are also with Albert Shafiev. Hello, Albert.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing here?
Very good. Pleasant morning. Thank you.
Okay, so Albert is the general manager at Elmeca. It's a medical device company, and he was also an ex-venture capital, right?
Correct, yes.
You have been here in Korea for over a decade, so you have a lot of experience living here.
It was a ride, yeah. I first came to Korea in 2012.
Mm-hmm. And where are you from originally?
Right. So I was born in Uzbekistan. So this is a country, one of the older post-Soviet Union countries. So it was part of the Soviet Union in the past.
Uh-huh. And what is your story? How did you arrive to Korea? What did you study? What did you first work in?
Right. So Uzbekistan is based in Central Asia. So it is still, there are similarities in the culture that I found when I later came to Korea. That was one of the vital points that helped me. As I was growing up, I was trying to be more international. I was always interested in globalization, and English language was the drive force for me. I started learning it quite early, around the age of 5. And I have older sister as well, so she had a big influence on me.
Was it common in Uzbekistan to learn English in such a young age?
I would say when you enter the elementary school, you can always choose a language that you learn in addition to your main language. And for a lot of people, English was the choice, yeah. Okay. But I started a little bit earlier because I was kind of more interested in it.
Wow, and when you were 5 years old, you were interested in languages?
Well, yeah, because like I said, I was trying to be more international, and my older sister was a good inspiration, because she was international as well. So when I was still a kid, when I was still going to school, she went to Japan. So she was the first one to start this international experience path. So she was already in Japan now more than a decade as well, almost 2 decades probably. Mm-hmm. And she went to Japan for her university, after which she started working. She was working in interesting companies like Rakuten and Toys R Us. Rakuten is basically Amazon of Japan. You can probably think of it like that. And after some point, she started her own company. So that was her path. And for me, as I was kind of being more interested in this, I was also interested in two areas of work and career, so to speak. One was law and legal studies, and another one was business development and entrepreneurship. So those were always my two areas of interest. So there is a Westminster University in Uzbekistan with a kind of international campus where we had some visiting professors from England. So originally it's a school that is from England. Mm-hmm. That is where I went for my undergrad. And again, my major was law, business law at that point, and that was really interesting. And as I was studying there, I was kind of thinking about what can be the next goal, right? The next thing to pursue. And I tried to scout for certain schools and certain locations that I was interested. Because of my sister, Japan was also very interesting, but she visited Korea a couple times for work and she liked it. And that was one of her recommendations. And I also had a chance to view some lectures from, let's say, visiting professors from Korea as well. So that was a very interesting experience for me. And I decided to apply here in Korea, where we are now, to Seoul National University. But I did a general application. So after my application, I got a message from one of the professors who said, oh, that's a very interesting application. We have this program that is focusing on intellectual property, which is one of your areas of interest, which is true. That was my highest area of interest. And he said, it's the first ever we do in English. Why don't you apply, right? So I applied for it. I was successful with my application. I was also very lucky to get the scholarship. So for me, the education in that master's program was founded by World Intellectual Property Organization. So thank you for that to them. So they paid for my scholarship. So I came to Korea, and that's how it started. That was all the way back in 2012.
Wow. And also I have a question, because for example, Laida also is super interested in legal and business. But one of the problems that we saw at the time of starting to study legal or law is that you are very focused on one country. So when you move to another country, the law changes.
Correct.
You kind of lose what you learned. How is that experience for you?
I wouldn't say you lose what you learn. So there are soft skills and hard skills, first of all. So we can talk about the skill base and then the skill application, right? Okay. So for the skill base, I would say as part of your training, you learn how to research, right? You learn how to find information, how to be more organized, how to plan yourself better. And these skills will be useful for you for your entire life.
Anywhere.
Whatever path you choose, right? So it kind kind of disciplines you a lot. And the hard skills, again, there are certain subjects that you learn, let's say the law of a certain country, right? But a lot of the countries are kind of following a certain general rules of certain treaties or things like that, right? So for example, for European Union, there's a lot of common laws that are used for a lot of European Union states. So once you know this foundation, you can apply it, right? And it gets a bit more specific country by country. And again, there's a common and civil law practices as well. So those are also like two major practices, right? So the common law are countries like United States and in England, they are practicing it. And this one is more based on the previous cases, right? And then there are civil law practices that are also in European Union. That was also in Uzbekistan and some other countries. So they are kind of focusing more on the rules establishment and then following the rules, right? Again, if you follow one of those practices, and you most of the times you do, you will also be able to kind of be able to transition from countries that apply them, right? So general terms. And then we can even take it further, right? So again, law by itself is a very general topic, right? But then you can try to make it more specific, right? So let's say litigation, that one, in my opinion, of course, very more country by country specific, right? But then something like contract law, right? Something like intellectual property, those are a lot more general. So you want to sign contracts no matter where you are, right? So whatever skills you will learn for that will be applicable in many locations. So that's how. But that being said, the most important thing, again, if you want to pursue the actual real litigation legal career, you need to be able to pass the bar, right? So you need to be able to pass the main exam in a country to be able to practice it there. And that one is very specific. So that will be the one that's the most biggest challenge for people, right? But for me, I am not a practicing lawyer. For me, more of a general, right? So again, so...
You didn't need to pass it, no?
That's why I didn't need to take this exam. That's why I can still utilize the skills that I learned. Yeah.
Okay. Really useful for you, no, Laida? Because she was actually considering studying law, and that was one of the obstacles.
Yeah.
So you decide to come to Korea, or like you apply to Korea, you arrive here. What are the first feelings that you had? Did you like it? Were you scared?
I was generally extroverted person, so I was very overwhelmed in a good way. So everything was new, right? This was my first real crazy, huge international experience.
How old were you?
I think I was 15 or 16 when I came.
Really?
No, sorry. I was 15 or 16 when I started my undergrad. So I graduated, I think, around 19 or 20. So around 19 or 20. So basically, I graduated. And then I came to Korea right away. I couldn't even attend my graduation ceremony because I already had to be in Korea. So it was basically back to back, right? I think I was, maybe 19 when I first came to Korea. I was still young. I was still learning the life. And then that was a crazy international experience. And then another thing, I think it really depends where you come from, right? So West and East culture, right? For example, if you're coming from US to Korea, it's a huge difference, right? So, but for me, again, because I was from a Central Asia, there are certain cultural similarities that I already was able to kind of get that helped me, right, in a way. So I was able to learn the Korean culture a little bit better because of the similarities, but still there was a lot of new things. And then the language was new, still the culture was new, the food was new, everything was new, right? So that was very great in the beginning, but once you pass this freshness of it, it starts to feel, right? The actual challenges start to come.
And what were your first steps to get a bit more involved into the business ecosystem in Korea, or your first jobs? How was that?
Okay, so this is also a personal experience, right? Type of a scenario. For me, when I just first came to Korea, I was doing legal, like law school. So I came here for the intellectual property masters. And we had some times in the afternoons or in the evenings, there was some free time where we were able to network, to meet new people, right? So we tried to join different clubs for extracurricular activities. And then through this, learn what kind of experiences different people have and try to adapt to the culture as well. For me, my work experience, my first work experience was, I think, a bit unusual if you compare to other people, because in addition to coming to another country, I was also working again in another country. So what happened is my sister, right, the one I mentioned earlier, so she's older than me. So when I just came to Korea, she was interested already in starting her own company. And that was one of her passions. So she found a really great co-founder in Japan. So two of them started a company in Japan. And that was exactly around the time when I was in Korea, so doing my master's program, right? So after a lot of kind of conversations with them, I came to Japan. So I stayed a little bit in Japan over a year to help them with their business. But I was still very, very young. I was like barely 20 years old. Not much you can do, right, without very specific experience. But I really loved it a lot. So I think that was the starting point of entrepreneurship journey for me. That's how I got into this in the first place. Mm-hmm. So what I felt like what you do matters. So your impact can be felt much faster when you're in a startup compared to a bigger organization. But also your responsibilities are higher as well, because again, of the same impact, right? So you don't have a lot of safe space and you need to be fast to make things happen. But I also learned that I really need to learn a lot more in business. So that's why I came back to Korea and I did MBA school. So I came back to Korea, I did Seoul National University again, but this time I went to Graduate School of Business to do the MBA program. And that's where really things took off for me.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So you think that an MBA is really useful?
I think it depends again on what people are trying to look for in their careers. For me personally, it was a great experience. It was a life-changing experience. I'm really happy that I went through it looking back. It was very, very challenging. And it was like a scenario where you have to make it or break it for me. And that was the time where I was able to grow a lot as a person.
And what are the main takeaways that you had from that experience?
Okay. So again, the input equals output. So it's a lot of these schools and experiences are directly connected to yourself. If you are there just for the experience and you are not engaging, you will not take as much from it, right? So you need to find your passion even before you go for it. So you need to have certain kind of goal in mind and plan before you even join. And then when you join, you need to try to chase that goal and try to expand on it wherever you can. So for me, right, specifically, my goal was to learn more about entrepreneurship and to be able to help people who start their own businesses. So that's something what I focused on, right? So I was trying to take as many entrepreneurship-related activities when I was in the program. Whenever we had those classes, I tried to be as engaging as possible with the professors and to study a lot more and join extra, like I said, clubs and activities based on that. And that helped me to learn more, to improve my network and get some connections that are still helpful to this day, right? Even though it's been almost 10 years. Yeah.
You said that you wanted to help people that were doing business. You never thought about being a founder?
Of course, I was thinking about being a founder myself. I still am thinking. Probably at some point in my life. We will see when we get there. I would say I was more realistic in a certain way that, let's say, at that time, I was barely 20. I was trying to find something safe first for myself before I can take the risk. Because if I kind of take a risk at that age, it's good and bad, right? So I waited out for some stability first. But some people don't have to do this. If they really believe in what they are passionate about, they don't need to follow me, right? And another thing is by working with a lot of founders, I also now, again, I almost spent 10 years in this entrepreneurship ecosystem. I feel like, and now I am working in a startup as myself as well, right? So that kind of will really help me in my future entrepreneurship projects, no matter what.
Do you have also experience in the startup ecosystem in the US, in Germany, in Japan, right? So what makes Korea unique in this startup ecosystem?
I see. So I would say there are a lot of different points. You probably discussed it on your earlier episodes, so I will try to mention some that I feel are the most interesting. So the first one is probably the impact of the government. So in Korea, the Korean government is very interested in the startup ecosystem, and it's really supportive of startup ecosystem. So every year, a certain amount of budget is allocated to startups in one way or another. And this can be felt in many ways. So there are funds where investments are done for startups and accelerators that operate and venture capital that kind of operate those funds. And they can only, let's say, invest, or let's not only, but they have to invest a certain amount of their budget into younger companies, the companies that are only a couple years old, the companies that are no older than 7 years, for example, right? They are very kind of very strict requirements on that. And in addition, from the startup point of view, now you are not kind of competing with these huge companies, right? Because one of the challenges I felt a lot of startups in Korea have is, first, there is a limitation of the market size. So not every industry can be able to host a lot of companies in it. And that's why those companies like future companies like Samsung's and LG's, they dominate those industries and it's hard to compete against them. And another one is the funding, right? So, and then that also connects to this investment. So now they are able to access this investment. Another way they can benefit from it, in addition to actual physical cash, there are also the skills development programs. So there is a website that's called K-Startup. You open it. I think at any given time, there are more than 150 programs that have applications open where you can apply and receive help. And like I said, some of them, yes, investment-based, but some of them are, they will give you office space for free. In Korea, a lot of places you can get office space for free, which is really good. So your costs are going down. This is really good for the earlier stage startups, right? Some of them can even help you to subsidize your employees. So let's say you have six team members, and that's, again, earlier stage startups not always generate stable revenue. So for them, a lot of the times, their own personnel is the very hard cap in terms of their expenses. So this is something that the government can help with. So let's say for your six employees or whatever you have, 50% of their salary will be covered by that program, right? So that is a huge relief for a startup. And then another one is from the learning side, right? So there are a lot of programs where they can learn specific skills, right? The accounting, legal, these are always extremely important for startups. And again, as a founder, you need to be able to do everything. And it's very difficult in the beginning when you don't have all the backgrounds. So you can learn all the most essential things for the startups through those programs. Very useful. What else? Even mentors, right? So there are a lot of programs where you join and there's some kind of business expert who knows that area, and they can tell you whether the business model you're thinking about is going to work or what you can do to improve it, right? And then just general business development. So what I am familiar with more is the global business expansion, right? So a lot of the Korean startups, they are interested in the global business development. But again, there are a lot of challenges. And one of the reasons why they are interested in global business development is because of, again, the limitations of the local market, right? Not all the industries can be huge. Not all the companies can be successful. So they're trying to expand their sales through the global business. But the challenges they have, again, time difference, culture difference, language difference, right? So that's why it's very difficult for them. That's why these global business development programs, that's where they come in. To help them, yeah.
And regarding those programs, how accessible are them for foreigners? Because I personally have tried to apply to some, and it was really difficult. Everything is in Korean. Even when you put the translator of the Google Translator, it doesn't really help. So what would you say about that?
Okay, so I think technically, when they upload those programs, they always write down who can apply very clearly. And a lot of the times, based on my experience, the main requirements are it's a startup, it's a company not older than 3 years, it is based in Korea, it was established in Korea, and maybe it's not fraudulent, right? So it doesn't have like tax problems or something. Like those are usually always the criteria. So which means technically you can also apply, right? If you're a international founder and you are in Korea. But this is being technical. In practice, it's a lot more difficult, like you said. So first of all, you need to be able to even fill up the application. And a lot of the times they are in English. I mean, sorry, they are not in English. They are in Korean, right? Which means either you already have a certain language knowledge of the Korean, which makes you be able to apply. And another route is you need to have someone who can speak Korean, who can help you. And that can be your friend, your coworker, or your co-founder, either way. But what I personally noticed that works best, if you have a Korean co-founder, then you can really take the most advantage of all of those programs.
Do you think it's viable to be a founder in Korea without any Korean co-founder, be just not knowing the language and trying to do a business here?
Well, again, it depends on what you're doing, right? So that's kind of a general question. But you don't need to technically apply for all of those programs to be successful, right? You can still start your business. It's more about the starting the business is about being able to sustain yourself, right? So you either have a certain technology and you can find an investor who gives you the money to develop your technology and test your technology. Or maybe you are already at the stage where you can start testing the product really quickly. So what I noticed is a lot of the software related startups, their development cycles are shorter than the deep tech, right? Than biotech, than other companies. So if you are a startup that has a software, you can develop it very quickly, especially if you have a technical co-founder who can develop. And then no one restricts you to upload it, right, on the Play Store. Mm-hmm. So people, you can start getting users and feedback really quickly. And if you have something that they like, they will start paying for it. Again, in this case, it doesn't matter whether you are Korean or not. I think what will matter in this case is how well you can market it and whether you have a value proposition. I think for a lot of startups, what happens is founders, they are interested in a certain project and they have a need for it. Yeah. But a lot of the times they don't test whether it's the same for the market, right? Whether the market wants what they want, right? And that's why a lot of them end up failing, because they build something that is good for them but not good for everyone. So I think rather than foreigner or not foreigner, you just need to plan whether you, how feasible it is, right? So whether you can develop it yourself, how can you put it on the market, and what will be the your potential revenue stream for you to be sustainable in the long term. But again, if you have, if you want to take advantage of being in Korea, it will help to be able to at least speak Korean. So if you're a founder and you don't have a Korean co-founder and you are international, you can still do it, but it's obviously more challenging, right? For example, you can go to US and test it there, right? Why are you based in Korea, right? There must be a certain need or a certain reason why you are here, right? And then if you are here, you might as well take the advantages of what's being offered here. Mm-hmm. It's for your own benefit in a way.
Mm-hmm. You were now mentioning a little bit about how to evaluate a startup, how feasible it is.
Yeah.
As a past venture capital, what are the main things that you look at in a startup?
Okay, so a lot of the times startups, let's say, fail because they don't have funding or they just run out of money. That's like number one reason a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. And they always try to fundraise. I especially noticed it in Korea. Fundraising for startups is very, very vital. I would say personally, it's good if you can fundraise, but a lot of the times you also need to understand that if you fundraise, you get people who are becoming your shareholders. So your responsibility automatically goes up a lot because you are now reporting to people who gave you the money for a certain purpose, right? So your freedoms are limited right away. Mm-hmm. You are now, in a sense, in a position where you can survive longer, right? So that's why they try to do it. So based on my experience talking to startups, and I had to talk to maybe hundreds of startups in a period of 2 months. So in a year, you can talk to 500 startups at least. No joke there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And after a while, you start to see a certain pattern, right? You see the certain industries. Let's say in certain industries, you start to see certain KPIs, certain factors that might be meaningful in a way, right? So with your experience, you can tell whether their chance of success, being successful is higher or lower based on your kind of conversations with similar previous startups, right? So if startups want to fundraise, I would say they need to meet at least a certain criteria, right, before investors will seriously consider them. Think about it, right? If someone approaches to you and says, okay, I have this idea, give me money, right? Most of the people will not do it. Mm-hmm. So for venture capital is the same. We are not using our own money. So venture capitals are, I mean, most of the time, sometimes they use their own, but most of the times venture capital also gets the money from banks, for example, from other institutional investors. So they have their own responsibilities. Mm-hmm. That's why they are trying to be very careful with that money. So they don't want to take high risks. They do take some risks, right? And in exchange for the risk, they get a bit better return, but they generally are not very, very risk, high risk takers. So they want you to have a really good past so that they can kind of be more sure of your future. So, and that can be many ways, many different things. So I will speak a bit more about software because it's the easiest example and I think very dominant in Korea as well. So let's say if you have a certain software with the value proposition, all you need to show is when you started it, how many users you have, right? So there are certain metrics that are measured, how active those users are and how many of them are actually paying you, right? And how is it changing? So with this data, you can kind of predict a little bit some stability and what's going to happen if the growth happens. And that gives some security for the investors, right? Mm-hmm. So they will be more interested in investing in you, and they will kind of evaluate you harder. They will go into due diligence on you to check other information about you. But if you are a bit earlier stage, it's harder, but not in Korea. Again, so Korea is very interesting because, again, if you compare with US, in US, not that many support programs. Right. They are out in the world. They are competing against everyone. There are so many more startups also, right? And their rent is not cheap. If you go to Silicon Valley, the rent prices there are just out of this world. It's so expensive. But here, you have government programs that give you office space. You have government programs that pay for your employees. You have government programs that teach you accounting and everything. And there are even government programs that give you early funding that is very, very beneficial. So, for example, there is a TIPS program, very famous in Korea, and it is one of the best startup programs. And it is targeted at early stage startups. When they are just, for a lot of those startups, this is their first fundraising. So if they get selected for this, they have freedom to test their company for at least a year or two, which means a lot of the times when startups in Korea, they are starting their first major round of the fundraising, they will always have kind of background, right? Some back data, mm-hmm. which will make it easier for them to fundraise as well. Mm-hmm. And then another advantage is they will still own a lot of the ownership in the company. So again, if we compare with United States, by the time, again, it's industry by industry, but when startups are entering Series A, they already lost around more than 30% of their equity. But when they are doing this in Korea, they still probably have 90% or even more at that point on the major founding members.
Mm-hmm. I see a lot the benefits of like a government support in the startup ecosystem, but I also see that there could be some disadvantages. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, now if like a private sector wouldn't invest in a startup, that might be because it's not good enough, you know, like mm-hmm. the market is not really wanted to buy that startup.
Yeah.
But the government would even either way give money to them. So do you think it's actually efficient for the government to be given so much support, or do you think they should step back at some point after the good work that they already did?
I would say even though government does support startups a lot, you also need to see it from their point of view. So for them, if those companies are successful, they are end up being a taxpayers, so that's how they get return on their own investment, right? So they still need to support local ecosystem, right? Yeah. That being said, for example, the TIPS program, the people who do evaluations, a lot of the times they are either tech experts, like professors in certain universities, or ex-VCs as well. So basically, those programs are always competitive, and they have evaluation criteria, which a lot of the times is similar than what the investors will actually look at. So I would say if the investors pass you, there are a lot of government programs that will pass you as well. So it's not like if you can't get one, you can get another, right? Yeah. It's a little bit easier, I suppose, for some of the government programs, like office space, for example. Those yeah. are not very expensive for the government as well, so and not that hard to get. But something like TIPS, it is one of the most competitive programs in Korea. There are actually startups that so basically to apply for the TIPS, one of the requirements is you need to get investment from one of the partner operators, right? Mm-hmm. And the Big Bang Angels is one of those operators. So you can't even apply before you get the investment from the VC. So you already need approval from VC first before you can even apply mm-hmm. for this program. And that's even cool. With that, not a lot, like I said, it's very competitive. A lot of the companies actually fail.
Mm-hmm. And you are also part, you mentioned Big Ben, mm-hmm. you are part of that company. What is your role inside that company?
Okay, so I used to be investment analyst. I was kind of managing a couple funds that we have. Right now, what happened is, this is a very interesting story. So while I was working there, I was working with the fund and we were investing into several startups with the fund. And one of those companies was actually Elmeca. So what happened is I ended up working
for them
for the company that is a portfolio company of the Big Bang Angels. So that's the connection. So you can think of it like an entrepreneur in residence, I suppose. That's the best match.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I see. Mm-hmm. And also, like, to talk a bit more about exactly your company that you're working now, can you explain what does Elmeca do? What are the products or services?
Okay. So Elmeca is a medical device company. It is based in Korea. And Elmeca is the world's first company that developed a automatic suction device for patients with different respiratory diseases. So let's say you have a lung, right? You need to breathe. And there is an airway that goes from your mouth to your lungs. Mm-hmm. And when you have certain diseases, this airway is blocked. So let's say when you have a very common example these days is the corona. So when you have corona, a lot of the times side effect of the corona is you get pneumonia. So your lungs cannot function properly. And let's say certain substances like mucus, they get They basically start to enter your airway. And your airway is blocked with this mucus. So because of that, you cannot breathe. Mm-hmm. And we can connect you to a ventilator, but you can give more air. But if the passage is blocked, you still cannot breathe. And people, unfortunately, still pass away. Mm-hmm. So that happened during this pandemic. So the only way to deal with this is to actually manually clear your airway. So what is the world standard procedure now? Nurse goes to a patient they are all in the intensive care. There's like life and death situation. So she goes to that patient. They use small tubes that they insert inside of your mouth that goes to the airway that is connected to your lung. And they suck that mucus out manually using the pumps. And this is the same procedure that was used for like 1,000 years. It's like going back. This is the same. Yeah, there was no innovation there. So basically, because of this, there are a lot of challenges. So first of all, you need nurses. And because, again, of the pandemic, there is a huge shortage of nurses now. The second, this is a very up-close and personal procedure, right? You need to be directly in front of the person you're doing it. And they have their mouth open. And generally, it's not that of a big deal. But again, when we introduce something like corona that is very contagious, now it starts to be very dangerous. That's why a lot of the medical personnel can get corona, right? So this is kind of a infection can spread out of the control. Again, this is something that happened. And that is also one of the reasons that affected the shortage, right? Because nurses were really concerned about this, right? This is not something they always want to do, right? Mm. And on top of all of this is already quite a few of challenges, right? On top of that, the skill of the nurse is very important, right? If they know they're more experienced, you're better off. But if not, they can accidentally scratch inside, and your airway is one of the most sensitive parts of your body. You can get infection and people pass away from that as well. So there's just too many risks involved. And then when they do this, there are so many different products they use, right? They need to have gown. There's a certain protocol in the hospitals that they need to follow to do the suction. And when they do the suction one time, maybe 10 or more than 10 different disposables are used from the point of view of the hospitals. And those are all challenges that our product basically fixes. So our machine, you just connect it to the patient who is in the intensive care. You just set it and you press the button if you want. There are like different functions, but I'm just talking the most common. You just press the button one time and for 24 hours, machine will take care of the suction for the patient.
What do you connect it to?
To the machine. So we have basically patients in the hospital, they always have already like E-tube or T-tube that we call. Mm. So our device can be connected to that.
Okay.
And our device has its own catheter, right? The thing that goes inside of the body. So let's say patient moves, it doesn't matter because everything is connected. And then let's say you want to do the suction every 30 minutes, the device will do it every 30 minutes. Okay. And keep the patient alive, basically, thanks to this. And because of that, the challenges I mentioned earlier are relieved, right? So the personnel is not as busy. We also had a huge pain reduction based on our studies. We did a couple clinical trials, one in the Seoul National Bungdang University. Recently was a presentation, very interesting, good safety and efficacy results. And also, you introduced the precision of the machine, which means skill of the nurse is not in the play anymore. So let's say you need to provide the suction for 10 seconds, right? This is a FDA golden standard. You need to do it for 10 seconds. But nurses, a lot of the time, they're kind of, because of the nature of the environment, they are eyeballing it, right? They can do it 9 seconds or 12 seconds, right? And let's say you need to insert the catheter exactly like 130 millimeters. Again, they are eyeballing. They're not measuring it. And because of that, you get the results that are varied. And the treatment will be different patient to patient. Some patients can pass away because of this. This is, again, intensive care, life and death situation. For us, you do the settings, how, what's the length you want, how frequently you want it, and how long you want it. And they're like other, but I'm talking about the main functions, right? Mm. And then the patient will get this stable treatment. And because we have only the main set of the disposables, we generate less waste. Mm-hmm. And in addition to for that being better for the environment, another advantage from the hospital point of view is that, first of all, when they do manual suction, they accumulate a lot of these disposables, but they can potentially be contagious, right? So it's not that cheap to get rid of it. So they need to spend their resources and budget. And when there's a lot, they spend more. But for us, it's less, so they spend less on that. And it's easier to take care of it. And maybe the final advantage, other than the initial setup, it's not as close and personal anymore, right? So yeah. Because of that, the risk of this disease spreading is reduced.
When are you planning to launch the product to the market?
Well, that's a good point. We have one product, the one I'm talking about. We already launched in the product. Mm-hmm. We already launched it. We sold some of the units. So we start maybe so active.
You sell to hospitals,
I assume. Yeah. So we have demo units in certain hospitals, but we also have clinical trial units. We still work on a couple of the clinical trials. And we do have some commercial units in the hospitals. So in certain hospitals, people get treatment with our devices in Korea already.
Okay.
Only in Korea, or are you going global also?
So going global was one of the big priorities for us in the last, let's say, year or two. Because it's a medical device,
so
you cannot just go and sell it, right? So there are a lot of regulations and approvals. Mm-hmm. So for us, the first major step was European Union. Mm-hmm. And in European Union, it's a CE mark, right, for the medical devices. And there was a big change. Maybe you are aware. So there used to be standard that was changed for the approval. So now it's called MDR. And MDR is basically upgraded guidelines for the regulations for the approval of medical devices. And they came in kind of into force as we were preparing the registration. So we had to follow these new guidelines. And it was a lot more challenging.
More challenging.
A lot more. That's so many companies now about to lose their license because of this problem, even though there were extensions. That is one of the major challenges for European Union market. But thankfully, we got lucky. We did pass. We got it at the end of the last, like basically like around the new year. So you can think of it as a Christmas miracle, I suppose. Yeah. We're very happy to get it. And now we're preparing to commercialize in Europe. And in addition to Europe, we're looking at other markets as well, like United States and more.
And do you have many competitors in US and Europe? Or
so the competition. So you should think of it as realistically. Remember I mentioned this manual method that nurses use. This is the competition. So the manual pumps, this is our competition. So for us, main challenge is to educate the market for us that we are the new thing that is the better, right? Mm-hmm. And to kind of encourage them to try our product. So for us, rather than the competition, the challenge is to getting the customers, because this is innovation, this is a new product. If you look back in the history, for example, the robotics for surgery, this was introduced many, many years ago, but still not as widely used in the hospital. So it takes a lot of time for the innovation to become the standard of care, so to speak.
And when you're selling this type of medical devices, do you think it's easier to sell to public hospitals or private hospitals?
So I would say if you have a medical device and you want to sell it, right, you want to commercialize it, from my personal experience, you will have different strategy based on each of those. You will have different strategy for public hospitals and you will have different strategy for private hospitals. For the private hospitals, because they're using their own budget, you need to justify their expense for your device, mm-hmm. right? You need to tell them very clearly, if you introduce this device, you will get better results. And not just clinically, but financially as well, right? This is something they care about because they need to run the business as well in addition to treatment. But for the public hospitals, because the budget is going from the government, it's a little bit different. Of course, they care about the money as well. But my personal feeling was that they care about safety. They care about the efficacy, the efficiency of your treatment a lot mm-hmm. as well. So you try to adjust.
Okay.
So and then again, based on which value proposition you have, you might have the value proposition that is beneficial for both of them, but maybe only for one of them. So you need to assess. Mm-hmm. You will know better, right? Mm-hmm. So you make assessment and try to approach one or the other first. And another thing is there are different agents involved, right? So for the government, maybe you do the tenders and procurement programs, but for the private hospitals, you either approach them by yourself or you have distributors that work on your behalf. So the sourcing channels are different as well.
Are you also doing like some inbound strategies or is only outbound?
So for us, I think for startups, it's not as easy to do marketing by themselves if it's a B2B. Mm-hmm. It's good and bad. So unless you have really good experts, it's hard to do it by yourself because it takes time to learn mm-hmm. And takes a lot of resources. So for us, for example, right, to do the marketing ourselves, which means we need to approach every single hospital by ourselves, mm-hmm. right? And we just don't have resources for that. So because of that, we in Korea have a distribution partner. And for Europe, the situation is a bit similar because, again, we are not even there physically, right? And generally, hospitals work with, let's say, established partners, right? Someone they already worked with in the past, right? So even if we go there, it will not be as easy to just go and sell to them directly. Mm-hmm. So that's why you need reliable partners to work with them together. So I would say that is also some challenge for a lot of startups. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how does this collaboration with your partners work? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if you can speak about a specific percentages that you give them, but or commissions. Mm-hmm. But I would also like to understand what are the economics. How much does it cost to produce one of your devices? For how much do you sell it? How much does the distributor get?
Right. I would say for economics, it's a bit difficult to share. Let's just say we have our own production cost, of course, and then mm-hmm. we sell device with the help of our distributors, and they also get their own profit from that as well, which is all very reasonable. But percentages, they are different industry by industry, product by product, so and case by case, so not easy to disclose. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what is the equity history of this company? When did you found it and have you received any funding so far?
So the company was established by the CEO all the way back in, I think, 2014. So it's already almost a decade. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of R&D going on, even going back. So we only, during this whole time, we're focusing on this one product to perfect it as much as possible. When there was development happening, they were working together with the doctors to kind of learn which functions are needed, right? What's the procedure that, like, what's the standard of care to try to adjust for it? And then they were trying to improve it over the years based on the information they learned. From the equity point of view, company already been through several fundraising mm-hmm. rounds. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much they attracted specifically, but let's say there are, including the Big Bang Angels, there are multiple institutional investors already in the company. Because it's more of a deep tech, and for the deep tech, it takes a while before you can commercialize it, especially in the medical. So I think medical industry for a startup is one of the challenging ones. Again, when I was comparing to the software, you can test it relatively fast and you can get it to market relatively fast. Yeah. But for the medical device, because of all the regulations, and it's a physical product as well.
You cannot do an MVP.
You do it, but it takes a lot longer, right? And just a lot of trial, a lot of testing takes a while. That's why, like, even though it's 2014, we just started commercializing like last year. So you see how long it took?
Wow. That's a huge bet from the founders and from the investors. But yeah, it's really like nice mission that you're trying to solve, like nice problem that you're trying to solve, because it can save lives.
Yeah, that is the main goal, to help people. Mm-hmm. For sure. Every time I was talking to the founders and the CEO, for them, yeah, saving lives is the priority. That's why they started it.
Uh-huh. Wow, nice. Maybe coming back a little bit about Korea.
Yes.
And the foreigner side, what are the main pitfalls or errors that foreign entrepreneurs face when they arrive to Korea?
So it depends on the stage where you are. Are you trying to give me...
At the beginning, when they arrive here, mm-hmm. they launch, what are the things that you think that they assume and are not like that?
Okay, so they are foreigners. They just came to Korea and they are entrepreneurs as well, right? Mm-hmm. And they're just starting their mm-hmm. company. So I would say, first of all, if they are here, they just started a company and they're coming to Korea, they need to have a certain goal. All right, they need to answer the question, why are they here? Is it because their product or service is in a certain industry that is beneficial for Korea? So for example, right, the entertainment and K-pop is really huge everywhere in the world. So that's why there are a lot of startups in this area are in Korea. So if you're international, it would make sense, right, for you to be here. If you're in the music industry, for example, right? But if you're like a generic product, right? Why are you here? But that's the first question you need to answer. And the second question, probably in Korea, when you're just coming, it's not easy, right? You mm-hmm. don't know people. So you need to see who you know or who you can connect with. So because foreigners are a little bit outside of the general circle of the daily activities, so they are a bit unique. Right, so they need to find unique solutions for them. They need to find people who can do something for them, right? So in their business. Let's say another challenge is the language again, right? If they just come to Korea, they just started a company and they cannot speak Korean, it will make it almost impossible for mm-hmm. them to be successful, right? And they don't know anyone, right? So I would say you need to prepare as much as possible beforehand. So you need to line up some meetings, some people you know. You need to make sure you can communicate with them. Otherwise, it's not productive, mm-hmm. right? If you start the business and you learn at the same time, it's very difficult, right? Because it's going to slow down everything. And for a startup, one day is like a week.
Okay.
The time is a lot mm-hmm. more essential.
And how do you meet people here? Both local businesses or local partners and also foreign community?
Okay. So for the local one, assuming you already know some people, right, that they can introduce. So a lot of business is done through introductions in Korea, right? So mm-hmm. who you know is really important. If you don't know, you just need to attend events. So you open the calendar, you look for the major events for your industry. So for example, as we speak now, in Coex, there's BioKorea, one of the biggest annual events for the biotech. Mm-hmm. So if you're in that industry and you're new, you need to be there and you're going to meet so many people there. But again, that is for both even. That one can help you with the local or global, right? There's like everyone there. So I would say look for the events. Another one is maybe the programs, right? So some of the government programs you do, you'll have like a cohort. So like a startup mm-hmm. school. We used to do it back in the previous company where I worked. So we do a startup school where like 30 different founders come together. So you meet other founders. You know, the interesting point, it's a bit off topic, but I want to mention it. Mm-hmm. Founders always try to network with like potential investors or like big companies, which is good. But you will be surprised how much help you can get from other founders. Mm-hmm. They see them as a competition, but it's not always like that because a lot of the times it's different industry, different products. But your struggles are very similar. So they will actually understand you the most. Mm. So I think networking for founders with another founders is really great way to expand your connections. So this is for local. For the global, thankfully, if you're coming to Korea like that, you are not the first, right? So, and it's been going on for a while.
You were the first.
I was one of the first. But if you're coming now, you are not the first. And there are already many, many interesting communities.
Like which ones? Can you mention
some? Yeah, a couple that come to the top of my head. Of course, is the Soul Startups, which is I'm connected with. So I was with the Soul Startup also. Startups, I think 2016, it's been also almost 5 years, I think, maybe more. Mm-hmm. And we have Marta there, who is the main hustler. So she is in Busan now, but she used to be in Korea. This is, I think, the biggest startup community, as far as I know, in Korea. There's a Slack channel. If you just type Soul Startups in the Google, it will come up, the website and Slack.
Yeah, the Slack, or, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Slack is split into a lot of different channels, and it's mostly for people, by people, right? So there are different channels, like visa questions, because, again, visa is one of, like, I didn't have a chance to talk about it yet, but visa as a foreigner is one of the main challenges.
Yeah.
You're coming here, but you need to be here.
50% of their times is just about visas.
So, and there are so many different types of visas. They all have different requirements. It's very confusing, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go to website, it's mostly in Korean. So people get stressed a lot just from looking. They're like, oof, you know? So thankfully, there are like communities like that. You go to Soul Startup, there you ask people, because again, people have been through this. And people are friendly. They will tell you what are the challenges they had, how to even do certain things, right? Mm-hmm. So this is Soul Startups is one of the good places. And then we also have the Garrison, right, with the Rizzo and the guys and the girls. There is also a very interesting startup community as well. There are a couple more. There is a Global Village with the Nihat on LinkedIn, very active. What else I saw? There are a couple more, but I think these are the main ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's another one. I don't know how many events they organize, but they have a cacao chat. They are called
Startup Club. Yeah.
Also the the French tech by there is also an interesting community. So it's supported by the French government, but they are also in the entrepreneurship as well. I think Isabelle is the person who's running it. You can check it on LinkedIn. Very interesting community as well. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are a lot of really good communities, but I'm just talking about the ones I am kind of personally engaged in and connected to, right?
Okay, and also regarding to why would someone want to come to Korea to do business? Like, what are the main advantages or the main opportunities that you see, industries?
Okay. So again, it's good to have a plan before you come, right? Briefly, I mentioned, so the K-pop entertainment, that's a place to be for sure if you have something to do with this, the music. Another one's the supply chain management in Korea is really good. So anything in this, like delivery, the inventory management, very, very interesting advancements in this in Korea. Farming is also interesting, because it's a limited space, a lot of interesting vertical farming as well. Mm-hmm. And then biotech and AI, blockchain, all these things were like big buzzwords. I think the current buzzword I heard a lot is kind of sustainability, right? Things like that. So all of this can be interesting. But I think you need to be more realistic, right? It's still a limited market, right? So one interesting thing is the internet penetration. Everyone in Korea, almost everyone is, I think it's maybe number one in the world by the usage on the phones, on your everyone.
90%.
So, yeah, it's not even close, right, to other countries. Like, and if your startup has anything to do with this, you have to be here just to test it, right? Because just by putting it on the marketplace, you automatically have access to so many testers, so many potential users, so many potential customers, right? And they are willing to try as well. So if it's very interesting, right, you can get, you can start really well here. That's an interesting place to test the anything for internet or IT.
Yeah. Actually, I was reading an article a few weeks ago about the edtech industry, and that now there's the mobile edtech industry is booming in Europe. I feel here could succeed a lot because everyone with the phone all the time. And also we have the public transportation that is a really big city, so we spend a lot of time in the subway.
Right.
And it's a really good moment to use the phone and to study a little bit. So I think that's also a good opportunity for people that want to come here in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, people, this will get noticed, yes. And also, as I briefly mentioned earlier, there are so many different government programs that you can utilize. I haven't seen anything like that anywhere.
No.
That is massive.
That absolutely. Yeah. Okay, also, there is one of the main challenges that some foreign startup have, like foreign, founders mentioned as, and is the part of recruiting. Recruiting foreigners and also recruiting local people, because here we have a culture in which normally young people want to go to big company, big corporates like Samsung, LG, or Hyundai. I think this is changing. Like many people say that it's changing, but there is also like this feeling, no, that they don't want to be in little startups, especially if they are foreign startups. So, what are some of the tips that you could say to these foreign startups to attract good talent? Okay.
That's a very good question. I can clearly see why it's a big challenge for a lot of founders. So back a couple of years ago, you maybe are familiar with the KSARP Grand Challenge, right? So that's one of the, I think, again, going back to what is a good thing.
That's you a could good, explain that yeah. because it's a really good program.
Sure. So the KSARP Grand Challenge is basically probably the biggest government program that is actually targeted on international businesses trying to land in Korea. So the whole purpose of that program is to basically create a soft landing for companies to try and find business in Korea. Partners, distributors, customers, you name it, right? Investors even, everything. So, and it's run by the government. I think NIPA is one of the main organizers for it, and I think Kyungi Innovation Center also work on it together. So, and also what they do, they basically bring up accelerators together to do this program, right, to run the program on their behalf. And usually in one cohort is somewhere between 50 to 60 startups. They land in Korea, and they will get a lot of benefits. So they will get some money actually to spend their time in Korea that they can use on their business. They will get consulting to open the business in Korea. They will get connection to, like I said, potential distributors or customers. And they will even get the intern who is Korean, right, who will help you with the translation. So what I mentioned earlier about the communication. So when they were designing this program, and they're doing it for many, many years now, so they know what are the main, right, pitfalls and challenges that startups have, so they try to cover those. And you will have around 3 to 6 months to kind of test everything while you're doing the program. So it is. I mean, there are a lot of challenges with that program as well. Like I heard like good and bad stuff about it, but I'm trying to focus on the positives, right? And as you do it, you will get to know a lot about the ecosystem here. So that being said, for the ecosystem, right? So connecting it to the previous question, when you are trying to expand to Korean market and you are part of these kind of programs, that's good. But if you're on your own, it's a bit more challenging, basically. Yeah.
And do you have any suggestion for people? Are there like any platforms to hire or to put your offers?
So going back to the hiring. So when we were doing this program, when we were doing this KSARP Grand Challenge program, again, we have international startups here. Yes, they do have an intern, but a lot of the times they open a company in Korea and they want to have employee, right? They want to have a Korean employee. There are a lot of challenges for sure. Yeah. So I would say first is the match, right? So let's say they want to hire a Korean person who will do a certain tasks for them. And that person needs to speak both Korean and English, right? So first of all, if a certain workforce already can speak English and Korean, just with this alone, they can find a pretty good job in Korea, which means you are competing against everyone, right? In a way, even though skill set is different, just by this criteria of being bilingual.
English here is super valuable.
So this bilingual criteria, right? It will assume that you are ready to pay more just for that. And then on top of that, they need to have a certain skill set and they need to be able to work with you. And you might be remote as well. So there's like extra challenges so that exists. And because of that, it's not easy to find employees. Because again, a lot of the times as a startup, it's not easy to pay higher salary, right? And another challenge is also the match, but different match. This match is the technical side. So let's say you are a startup and you need AI engineer or you need a software developer. It's really difficult to find.
Mm.
So what happened is Naver, Kakao,
yeah,
all of those companies, they already hired all the best developers, all the AI programmers. They are working with them. And they are paying high salaries. Mm-hmm. I heard like at least $100,000, even more. And they give them huge packages like work from home, work whatever time
so
you want.
So many benefits.
Yeah,
right?
So many benefits. Even like hire vacation days, blah, blah, blah. You can name it. Like, and then you are coming in.
A little startup,
not as established, even close. Mm-hmm. And you can't even pay maybe half of that.
Yeah.
So again, you are just out-competed to a, such a high range that makes it very, very difficult. So just based on that, and that actually applies not only to like those international startups, but even local Korean startups are the same. They have the same struggles. There is no way they can afford that much salary, right? And they try to find better ways. They're trying to be more flexible or give out some stock options, something like that, or some like commission on the sales for some like good marketing people as well. That helps a little bit, but even with all that, it's still difficult.
Yeah.
So it's the same problem for everyone.
Mm.
For me, the interesting side is that we have been talking with a lot of people that have been working in corporate and then now they are working in startups. And they always say that they prefer startups, even if the salary is lower. So I think it's a matter of culture and perception on what I should do rather than what I really want to do. Because I feel like people really want to experiment what working in a startup is, but it's difficult for them to take this path.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because there is always price for everything, right? So and you also need to think about like opportunity cost. So what happens is
if you financial.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think as we live our lives, it's always important to weigh the decisions, right? So, for example, when we were talking earlier, you go to MBA, right? So, first of all, you need to pay for the MBA. Luckily, I got good scholarship, but MBA program is usually one of the most expensive ones, right? But then, in addition to the cost you pay, you are also paying your own cost of your own life. So, you will spend 1 year, 2 years on that. In those 1-2 years, you can potentially work in another place and you will have 2 years of salary that you potentially gonna lose. So you need to think very carefully how long it's gonna take for this investment to be valid, right? Mm-hmm. So MBA is more of a long-term investment, right? So with it, you will learn certain things that, and you probably will have pretty good increase in your salary after you graduate, but still, like I said, you're going to spend the cost of the program. You're going to spend the cost of the not working for 2 years because most of those programs are full time. And it's going to take you anywhere from 5 to 8 or maybe even 10 years to get return on your investment, right? So that's a really long term. And the same is it working in a startup, right? So from that AI engineer point of view, he's getting 100,000. If you go to startup, he's going to get maybe 40,000. So he's going to automatically lose 60,000 a year just by working in that startup. Yeah. So a lot of the times that's why they are interested to try, but I think they also understand that. Yeah. And what happens is some of them are actually interested to try, but they can start their own startup, right? So that's why they're more engaged into this.
Mm.
So why work in a startup if you are such a rare commodity, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're such a rare workforce and in such a high demand, so you can try to start it by yourself. And a lot of the times, I think it's very interesting. I see the software, they start it as a side project in addition to their job as well, right? So they can test it out. They don't need to leave their job for earlier tests. And if they get some traction, then they can make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And the same in the startup. Like, you can just jump into it all in. I'll be happy for you.
Step by step, yeah.
But you can kind of try to plan as much as possible first, and then talk to people, learn from them, and then try certain things before you jump into it. But I am a more of a, let's say, less also of a risk taker. That's why maybe also I'm not as fit as kind of to jump in right mm-hmm. away. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Maybe according to you, how do you see mm-hmm. this ecosystem evolving in the next 5-10 years? What are your predictions?
Okay. So again, the trends change, but mm-hmm. I felt that the government still invests in this ecosystem a lot. I don't think it's going to last forever, but I think, yeah, maybe 5-10 years sounds reasonable that the support will stay. The trends might change, but the support, like I said, will still be there. One thing I noticed, again, in the past 10 years, let's say everyone was learning together. So the certain programs, because when I was just joining the accelerator here in Korea, right, it was just the starting point of the entire startup ecosystem in Korea. So 10 years ago, like 2016, that was just the starting point when the government started to invest a large amount of budget. Mm-hmm. But now, it's already 2023, over this period of time, they evolved. They got a bit more educated and they know what works, what doesn't work, right? So they're going to keep expanding on what works. That would be my best guess. So again, if you're a startup based in Korea, you will still have access, I think, to all of those programs. And hopefully the value you get from those programs will also get better. But another thing is, I feel like it's going to get more and more competitive. So when I saw the quality of the startups in the tips over the years, it always got more better, more competitive. Like, you need to have more milestones done. You need to have stronger team. You need to have stronger potential, more interesting technology, maybe even better innovation before you can get selected, right? So the cutoff gets harder with years as well. And I think that's going to stay as well. So, and if you check, I think the statistically, I'm not sure, but maybe the number of startups, at least when I was checking a couple of years ago, like, it kept growing as well. So your own competition, if you are a startup, is also increasing in a way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And again, another thing is, you've seen what happened with the corona, right? The whole pandemic and the situation in the world affected a lot. The situation in this ecosystem as well. So what I felt in the beginning and what's going on now, so the conclusions I can draw now, there is a lot less free money, so to speak. So the investors are a lot more careful with their investments. Yeah. Let's say something that they could have been like, okay, let's invest 3 years ago or 2 years ago even, they will not be as careful now. They will be a lot more careful with their due diligence, and they will want to reduce their risks even more because banks are not giving as much money for the investment. Like, yeah, the institutional investors are not providing as much money as they did 3-4 years ago. And then there were cases where some startups failed that also created a burden for the venture capital. So they are also a lot more careful with their money now. And then overall, economy declined quite a lot in the last couple of years, right? It is partially recovered, but I think it's still going to take maybe 2 years at least before it starts to go back. So I feel like now is honestly one of the challenging times if you are a startup. And again, I think in the last year or last year and a half, a lot of companies went out of the business because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's not the easiest of times. But then again, if you can make it in this challenging time, then
you can make it ever.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. We have a final question that we always ask to all of our interviewees, but is there something else that you want to say before we throw this last question?
maybe just to kind of continue last point a bit more. I think if you are interested in entrepreneurship and this is something you feel passionate about, it's great. You already found something what most of the world trying to find, right? So their own passion, their own goal. So I'm really happy for you, first of all. Welcome. And second of all, I know it can get very discouraging. It can get very difficult. But especially in Korea, I felt like the culture is not very welcoming of failure, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, in the entrepreneurship, it's almost a must. Like, you cannot make it until you fail along the way, maybe even a couple times. So I met people who failed 3, 4, 5 times, but they still kept going at it, right? And then finally something happens, because you will learn more from failure than mm-hmm. from making something really easy or happy or great right away. So don't look at the curve like it's just kind of just a straight line that keeps increasing with the time you invest. It's usually pretty low first, and then you will get a spike mm-hmm. after a certain milestone that you will reach. So keep pushing.
Well, thank you. Okay, so the last question would be, if you could recommend any source of learning, it can mm-hmm. be a book, it can be a mm-hmm. podcast, it can be an author, anything you want relating maybe to entrepreneurship.
Okay, so two things. Education is really good. It's very nice to invest in yourself and learn. But what I learned also, a lot of these books, they are very either case specific or relevant to their time. Mm-hmm. So when you try to learn through this, you should try to take away the ability to do research with it, ability to utilize it to your specific case. Because a lot of the times people buy like the book, oh, how this company got successful, and they're like, oh, okay, there was no internet at that time, or like the internet just started, so they were one of the first. So it's not going to work now. Yeah. So don't try to chase that. Try to chase more of a skills. In terms of the book, I think a couple really good ones that I enjoyed, I can recommend. The Shoe Dog, so that was the Nike storybook. The story was really interesting. It was well written. Even though it's based on what happened in the past, a lot of interesting, I think, mindset you can learn from it. And then for more relevant now, maybe 0 to 1, right? Mm-hmm. That was also a very interesting book. And I think if you're more of trying to understand the investor mindset, I think The Intelligent Investor was also a very interesting book. But I think these three will make you rounded in a lot of different areas of entrepreneurship. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Albert, for coming today. It was a really nice episode.
Yeah.
Many actionable tips, I think.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
If you want to keep updated on the Korea startup ecosystem, don't forget to follow us. And if you have any question or you would like to participate in one of our interviews, send us an email to koreastartuppodcast@gmail.com. See you next week.